Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Karen Lee Overman. She is an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs, in the US, and she also belongs to the Center for Cognitive Archaeology there. She recently completed 2 years of postdoctoral research at the University of Bergen. She earned her doctorate in archaeology from the University of Oxford as a Clarendon Scholar. She also has a master's degree in psychology and a bachelor's in anthropology, philosophy, and English from UCCS. She is the editor of Squeezing Minds from Stones, Cognitive Archaeology, and the Evolution of the Human Mind. So, Dr. Overman, thank you a lot for taking the time to come on the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Well, likewise, it's an honor for me as well.
Okay, great. So let me just ask you some general questions to start off with. So, in our revolutionary history, when can we start talking about archaeology and archaeological remnants? I mean, when did we start creating things, tools, etc., that are considered archaeological remnants?
Well, the oldest tools that are currently known are 3.3 million years old. So I would say archaeology begins, or the material that's available for us to look at as archaeologists is quite old. And so I think one of the other questions that comes up is how do you recognize that something was used as a tool? And this is a bit more difficult because a lot of things that are used as tools by non-human species are things that don't preserve archaeologically. Apes build shelters out of tree bits, and tree bits don't preserve. So there are a lot of things that we can't see in the archaeological record. So for most of the history of tool use, what we see archaeologically is what we call stones and bones. So we see the stones that have been knocked together in some way or used as a tool, and this leaves marks or chips off the stone, and you can tell that it's not a natural fracture. In terms of bones, I don't so much mean that we look at fossils because that's paleoanthropology and we're archaeologists, but when a hominid ancestor takes a bone and scrapes it with a stone, that leaves marks on the bones. And so we look at those marks and infer something about behavior, maybe food resourcing, from what we call worked bone. So stones and bones for millions of years, and that's it. It's thin because there's a lot of things we just don't see, but we have to go with what we can see.
When you're at an archaeological site, is it easy to distinguish something that is just the result of a natural occurrence, a natural phenomenon, from things that were created to serve as tools by a human being or another animal, for example, because I know that there are also other primates that create and use tools. I mean, is it that easy to distinguish?
That's a really good question. In some cases, it's not. So I work with numbers, and if there is even a fairly recent society that is counting by means of stones that they've collected together, I'm not going to be able to tell that pile of stones from any other pile of stones. It's archaeologically invisible, and those are what are called manuports. Naturally occurring objects that have been picked up and used as material culture in some way, but we can't tell. Maybe the difference in location is significant, but if that isn't meaningful, then we just can't see those either. But to try and distinguish our signatures from the signature of another non-human primate. For example, the stone tools that are made by different monkeys today, they don't tend to leave as obvious or overt as an archaeological signature as our ancestors seem to have. And part of that gets into how the degree of work that goes into creating a tool, maybe the longevity of use. What I'm trying to distinguish here is what's called ad hoc tools. So a non-human species, they tend to need a tool, they'll make a tool, they'll use it, and then they'll throw it away, and it'll never get used again. So it doesn't have the potential to accumulate the same kind of wear marks that might make it jump out to us as a tool, where our ancestors seem to have used them in that fashion to begin with, and then over time they start investing more time in fashioning them as tools so that they develop characteristic features, and those are what tend to stand out when you're at an archaeological site.
Mm-hmm. Would that be one of the reasons why we have cumulative culture and other primates do not? I mean, the fact that other primates throw away their tools once they're used them and things like that.
I think we start to see, there's a very slippery slope between cumulative culture and not. So the definition of cumulative culture is culture that builds on previous things. And what we see in the archaeological record for millions of years is long periods where there's really no innovation in stone tools. So maybe a million years where the form of stone tools really doesn't change. And that doesn't seem to be very cumulative. What it does seem to be, though, is habitual. It's habitual stone tool use, and that we do see in non-human primates. And that, I think, is sort of conditional. If you have a primate species that's terrestrial, so they can do things on the ground rather than being mainly up in the trees, and they're not under any threat of predation so that it's safe for them to come down on the ground and stay there for a long time. And maybe the only food that's around is something that is a nut in a hard case, and the only way to get at it is to pound it with a rock. If you have those specific conditions, what you see in capuchin monkeys in Panama, for example, is you see them becoming habitual tool users. Now, what that does is it opens up possibilities for them to get familiar with the tools, for the tools to start changing under the force of use and accumulating wear characteristics, and then you start having the potential to develop something that is intergenerationally transmitted, and it persists as a behavior. And this is exactly how I think it would have started with our ancestors. And if you look at the archaeological record, it starts very, very slowly, and it changes very, very incrementally up until about the last 10,000 years, where the pace of innovation goes from really being horizontal to being vertical. It's quite astonishing. So the last 10,000 years is completely different. So when I talked to Tom Wynn, who our volume, Squeezing Minds, was in honor of his body of work, because he's one of the founders of cultural anthropology. But he thinks cumulative culture really starts becoming cumulative in the sense of building on other innovations to where you can see it in things like stone tools, maybe in the past 20,000 years. He says in his estimation, it's a pretty recent phenomenon. Of course, this is one of the things that archaeologists like to argue about, so it's very unsettled. Who you ask is the opinion you'll get.
Yeah, sure. So today we're going to focus our conversation on one branch of archaeology, that is cognitive archaeology. We're going to talk about language, numerosity, and things like that. So could you give us or explain what is cognitive archaeology as a discipline, and perhaps give us a little bit of its history?
Sure. So a cognitive archaeologist is an archaeologist who's interested in cognition, some facet of cognition. And I'm going to talk about two different branches, and the first branch has two different sub-branches. So if you're an evolutionary cognitive archaeologist, you're interested in how human cognition evolved from what we think are ape-like antecedents to modern human cognition. So there's a couple of different techniques you can use. Tom Wynn and Fred Coolidge practice what is called descriptive pattern analysis. So if you take something like stone tools that has a very long temporal signature, millions of years, and you look to see how that form has changed throughout time, then those changes become informative about behaviors and psychological reorganization. And so what you see in stone tools is you see from just two rocks being banged to produce a sharp flake, maybe thrown away after that, Gradually, the part that is remaining starts being shaped a little more definitively with what eventually, by a million years or so ago, with bilateral symmetry, so symmetry in two planes. And that has implications both for behavior, because they're investing more time in making the tool, and in the ability to appreciate symmetry visually. So there are cognitive implications in the change in form that are related to how human cognition changed from its ape-like antecedents. So that's one branch of evolutionary cognitive archaeology. Another branch that was started at about the same time by Colin Renfrew, who's a very big name in British archaeology, probably the biggest name in British archaeology, is a more philosophical inquiry into the nature of cognition and the role of materiality in it. And so if you're looking at the brain as something as coextensive with the mind, and a lot of people do, they are saying, well, not so fast. The brain isn't necessarily the mind. The mind is something more than the brain. And I'll give you a good example. So when you are reading, that's a cognitive state that absolutely requires that you interact with the material form, which is the words on a page. So that's a cognitive state that necessarily involves a material form. And so there's a really good example of how cognition is extended. And it necessarily involves, as a component of it, a material form that isn't part of the brain. And so the perspective from philosophy of mind that the British school is adopting is what's called 4E. Cognition is in a body, it's embedded in an environment, it's extended to include material forms, and it's inactive. It simply is the interaction between brain, body, and world. So that's another inquiry, very philosophically inflected. Then there are what I call the ideational cognitive archaeologists. They're interested in trying to infer belief systems. What did people think? Not how did they think through material devices, but what did they think? And so they are the ones who analyze artwork for belief systems, shamanism, religions, cosmology. And that isn't what I do. I'm on the evolutionary side, and I'm a product of both the American school, having studied with Tom Wynne and Fred Coolidge, and the British school, having studied with Lambros Malliforis, who was, of course, Colin Renfrew's student. So there you go. That's cognitive archaeology. Tom Wynne describes how it started as, you know, it's sort of in the 70s, there was this reaction to what preceded it. Which was a very rigid materialism. They were trying to make archaeology very, very scientific. If it wasn't directly there in the material, you weren't free to speculate about it. And there were pockets of people that were starting to rebel against this, that it was too rigid, and they weren't just interested in describing archaeological material. And there are people that do, and you can you go to an archaeological conference, and it's, you know, PowerPoint slide after PowerPoint slide of everything that got dug up and how much it weighed, how big it was, what color it was, what chronology it was dated to. And it's all great data, don't get me wrong. But I think what we're really interested in is who made it? What were they like? How were they different from us? And those are the questions that started really burning against this insistence that only the material was there to inform you only about the material. And so there were people like Tom who were saying, well, wait a minute, maybe we can do something else with that. And there are a couple other people that were the early pioneers, like John Gallet and Colin Renfrew and Kathleen Parker, or Kathleen Gibson, rather. So that's just a turn in the archaeological thinking, and it dates to about three decades worth at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah. Is there any foundational or central theory that guides all of these sub-branches of cognitive archaeology that you describe?
Well, part of me just wants to tell you, heck no, we're archaeologists. We don't do theory. And part of me recognizes that that's a very flippant answer. So I would say that theoretically, the state of the field is unsettled, which is actually good. It shows that we're trying a lot of things. We're seeing what works. We're exploring. We're making new discoveries and achieving new perspectives. And when something quits yielding those kind of fruits, then we move on and try something else. So at this point, you know, it's everything from what genetics can tell us, what comparative species behaviors can tell us, certainly what neuroscience of you know, modern humans can tell us. But it's geography and climatic data. It's, I mean, you name it, we can probably figure out a way to apply it. There's, in fact, I got asked earlier this week if I knew anybody that was doing this kind of analysis on food. What did people like to eat? And I'm not personally knowledgeable of anybody that's doing that work, but you could. You absolutely could.
Yeah. And I mean, since you're trying to understand the cognition of ancient peoples from traditional societies like hunter-gatherers, horticulturalists, and others, do you think that modern society, modern traditional societies like the ones I enumerated here, are good models to the more ancient ones? I mean, that we can study those societies and extrapolate something from them to the societies that existed tens or hundreds of thousands of years ago.
Well, the basic problem we have there is the recognition that modern peoples definitionally are not the same as prehistoric peoples. Having said that, they often, a traditional society often has a lifestyle that we see as closer than the Western industrialized lifestyle to what would have been true of prehistory as well. And I think that's a good basis for gaining insight, but not as a good basis for direct comparison. Because we have, you know, 30 or 50 or 100,000 years of cognitive change in between the two. So you get into some, I don't want to just dismiss it as sensitivity issues. There's some real cognitive issues that come up because they're separated by 30, 50 or 100,000 years. And nonetheless, there is value in getting that kind of insight. Because if you understand something through a hands-on experience, you have a different relationship with it than if you just understand it theoretically. And so, you know, in philosophy, they have this famous thought experiment about Mary, the color scientist, who lives her whole life in a black and white world. And one day she knows everything about color, except she's never experienced anything except black and white. And then one day she is exposed to the color red. And the philosophical issue is, does she learn something new by experiencing red that she didn't understand through all the knowledge she had about the color independent of the experience? And arguably, I think she does. In an ethnographic sense, I have a colleague, Matthew Walls, who works with Inuit people in Greenland, learning their traditional techniques for building and sailing kayaks. And so at the other end of the spectrum, you might have an engineer who understands fluid dynamics, but has never set sail in any kind of a boat. And that's a real separation of the kinds of knowledge. And I would say that they're both coming at the same phenomenon, which is sailing a boat on the water, but from two vastly intellectual disciplines and perspectives. And you really can't substitute the one for the other. They give you different insights about the same phenomenon. So I would argue that the modern ethnographic analogy is somewhat akin to that. We understand certain things better than we did before, but we're still not getting exactly at the phenomena that we're interested in.
Mm-hmm. So what are the sorts of things that we can learn about a particular person's or people's cognition when we look at different archaeological remnants, like, for example, modified stones? I mean, what are the, when we look to them, what are the kinds of information that we can get about the psychological aspects of the people that produce those stones?
Well, let's look at ad hoc stone tool use. I need to crack open nuts. I got a heavy hammer. I got a solid surface to put the nut on, and I whack the two together. I break open the nut, I eat the nut, and I never come back to that site again. First, that's a little bit difficult to distinguish in the archaeological record, because that may not have left enough marks on the stones for us to see it as an archaeological site. But let's say we do see it, and what that tells us, it tells us something about the food resourcing strategy. And we can also infer something about the conditions that let the particular species stay there and engage in that kind of behavior. In a modern example, there's a reduced threat of predation, so they can stay on the ground longer without worried about, I don't know what's in Panama, probably not tigers, but parts of Asia 30,000 years ago or 100,000 years ago or 1 million years ago, maybe they were worried about, getting pounced on by a tiger and eaten. So the longer you're on the ground, the more exposure you have. So if you're able to come down and be there at least long enough to start using tools sufficient to leave an archaeological mark behind you, then you probably aren't under such a serious threat of predation, or at least you're hungry to the point where you don't care anymore. And so just from the simple marks on stones that have been used in this way, we can infer something about resourcing and environmental conditions. And with diet, if we also have access to the bones of the species, they can do mineral analyses of teeth enamel, for example, and they can come up with some indication it's an isotope analysis. They can come up with some indication of what this species was eating. You put that together with some environmental data about what flora and fauna would have been there and what climatic conditions were like, and pretty soon you have, from a relatively simple indication of the use of a stone tool, you've got a fair amount of information about an ecology and the being in it. I don't know that that really tells you anything psychologically more than that their behavior and their psychology is very much like what we would see in modern non-human primates. But it's certainly an indication of tool use. And if, it's 1 million years ago, we kind of assume at that point you're sort of ancestral to us, and it helped, what you were doing back then helped make us what we are today.
Is there something that we can learn about the difficulty in creating the kinds of archaeological remnants that we find and the sort of movements that people have to make, and also perhaps some of their psychology when we ourselves nowadays try to recreate ancient artifacts?
Well, there's a couple of issues there. One is, I think it's tremendously valuable to do hands-on with these technologies because it does give you insights. It's like the kayak example I mentioned a few minutes ago. You get different insights, the feel of the boat in the water and what makes a boat better than another boat and the manufacturing that went into making that property. You get a very different insight into the technology if you're actually doing the hands-on, not just in manufacturing, but also in using. And I have a friend who literally butchers carcasses in the field because he wants to know how, what makes a usable stone tool, which he also made himself by shipping it out of the some raw stone. So yes, I think it's tremendously valuable. The problem we have is the problem that we can come up with a solution that looks like it has the same result. It's not necessarily the solution. It's not necessarily the exact thing the ancestral or prehistoric species was doing. So, for example, in formulating glue, there's a couple of different ways to do it that yield a useful adhesive. And, so it's the kind of ingredients they would have had access to. It's the kind of technology for melting and combining that they would have had access to, but we don't know exactly that this is truthfully what they did. And so there's always a certain amount of ambiguity. It's good insight and it helps you understand the problem better, but it doesn't give you a guaranteed answer, I guess is sort of the bottom line. So yeah, but the hands-on, there's just it's Mary the color scientist. There's really no substitute for the experience of red. You understand something different. I'm on that side of the answer in the philosophical debate that there really is something that she learns that she didn't know before.
And by using technology, like for example, stone tools, wood tools, and things like that, is it the case that these technologies expand our cognitive capacities? Do we know something about that?
Well, the classic argument has been that bigger brains make better tools. And so the idea is that tool use helps get you better nutrition. Better nutrition releases selective pressures against bigger brains. Bigger brains are more powerful brains, and they help you invent bigger tools. And I'm not denying that that is part of what goes on, but from the standpoint of what Lambros Malliforis calls material engagement theory, this idea that materiality is an active part of our cognition, that's not all that's going on. And so by virtue of using the tool, you're also making a change in the brain. If nothing else, for early stone tools, those users are becoming familiar with the properties of stone tools, and those stone tools are changing under the demand of use. So they're wearing in ways that really reflect their use, and maybe this emphasizes certain features. And as the user is getting more familiar with that tool, the fact that it's changing means they're also maybe noticing what makes it more usable or more comfortable or more effective in smashing nuts out of shells. But there's always going to be some differences because, biomechanically, our hands are different from ancestral hands, and our shoulders and arm movements are different from ancestral shoulders and arm movements. And the thought is that using tools helped influence the development of the kinds of hands and ability to move the shoulders that we have. So it's very difficult to establish original causes and clear cause and effect lines because my suspicion is the causality flows back and forth. That these things, once something starts, then it's a trajectory of change. Things are changing together and they're helping each other change that starts you on this arc of change, this trajectory of change that makes us what we are today and different even from species like the Neanderthals, which were our closest cousins till they died off.
And okay, so a follow-up now that is a more specific question. In terms of the evolution of concepts and the concepts that we use, is there any relationship between them and the kinds of tools and materials that we use to create artifacts or tools, like for example, the materials we manipulate and observe, do they have any influence in terms of the concepts that we hold in our minds?
Well, I would argue, in fact, I do argue, especially when it comes to numbers, because a lot of the work that I do is in number systems and the material devices that are used in number systems. And so it starts out as a non-empty system. So we share with other species the ability to appreciate quantity. We can recognize one, we can recognize two, and we can recognize about three. And that's a specific part of this evolutionarily provided perceptual system. And then when it gets larger, the quantity gets larger than about three or four, then what we can see is many. And if you have two groups that are many, you can tell if the size is above a certain threshold, you can tell that one group is larger and the other group is smaller. And so that's our basic perceptual experience of quantity, and we share this with all kinds of other vertebrates, not just mammals, but birds, amphibians, reptiles, and fish. And it's been argued that even insects share this ability to appreciate quantity. So to that, for humans and the hominid lineage, we add the ability to manipulate material culture. So instead of staying with just the perceptual experience of quantity, we start saying as many as the number on my of fingers on my hand, and then as many as the numbers of fingers on both hands. And we start getting concepts of 5 and 10, and it also starts structuring numbers with a basic fiveness or tenness that we would call a quinary or a decimal system. If we count with our toes as well, we end up with a base of 20 called a vigesimal system. But the problem with using your fingers to count is that sooner or later, you're going to need your hand for something else, right? And so what we start doing then is incorporating material forms that basically do what the fingers do for counting, but they do more of it and they do it for longer. And you might call this a tally, right? A series of notches. Well, that's great. It gets you out of the set of limitations you have with the fingers, but tallies have their own limitations. And sooner or later, you start to realize that the more notches I have, the harder it is to use a tally. So maybe I'd like to be able to group them together because I can appreciate a group of quantities, maybe a group of 10 or a group of 100. I can appreciate that more quickly than I can just going back and counting them all again. So you come up with something manipulable, maybe stones. In Neolithic Mesopotamia, it was little clay geometric shapes they call tokens. Another way of looking at it is it's the antecedent of the abacus. In Polynesia, they had a counting sequence that set aside one of every 10 items, and then the set asides would be counted in the same way, only now these aren't tens, they're hundreds. And so you have exponential structure and grouping being created by either the devices or the behaviors. And sooner or later, you might need notations. And notations bring in qualities like concision, and the ability to represent large volumes of information that allow you to start getting a sense of numbers as a relational system. So from the perceptual experience of quantity through the incorporation of a bunch of material technologies, you end up with a modern concept of number, the way we understand what a number is. And that's all driven by the recruitment of these material forms and the incorporation of their properties as numerical properties, like manipulability and linearity and concision. And so I would absolutely argue that a conceptual system is built out of material engagement and long periods of time. And there's support for this view in the brain also, because the cerebellum, which for a long time was thought to be limited in its functionality to the gross motor movements, walking, and the unconscious motor movements like breathing and digestion, that it actually has, it's active in higher order thinking like mathematical concepts and abstract concepts. And so this, my suspicion is this long history of using tools has helped us shift and co-opt brain functionality for motor movements to become brain functionality for conceptualization. And today we just, you know, it's all delivered to us from our inheritance. So it's easy for us. It's the question for us as cognitive archaeologists is trying to understand the process that yielded all of this stuff.
And does that happen also for, in the case of language? I mean, is it the case that the brain regions that we use to produce and understand language are also the same that we use to, to make some movements to create objects or tools or something like that?
There's an argument in the evolution of language that, so the short answer is not directly, because there's an identified network of areas in the brain for language, Wernicke's area, Broca's area, and some things like the angular gyrus, that are distinct from the motor cortex, which is the part of the brain that's, and the cerebellum, which are the parts of the brain very, very active in physical movements. Having said that, there's an argument in the evolution of language that says, well, in motor movements, we've been able to combine sequences of movements so that the result is very complex, and especially in making tools. where you have these chains of movements that must be performed, and they can become very complex to make a very complex tool. And it's that underlying ability that also underlies the ability to put sounds into words, words into phrases and sentences into discourse, making from simple sounds and simple actions, making very complex arguments. Not everybody buys that view of the evolution of language. It certainly recognized that language doesn't go back nearly as far as tool use does. So it's something that seems to have emerged subsequently, and there are people that argue that it emerged very, very recently, maybe within the past 100,000 years, where we've been using tools for at least 3.3 million years that we can see archaeologically. So there's a lot of ambiguity on this particular question.
So, I mean, you mentioned the last 100,000 years, so are there people that believe that language only emerged when we're already almost sapiens in the world, or?
Yes. So the species that is Homo sapiens is thought to have emerged about 200,000 years ago. And so what we do then is we differentiate anatomically modern from behaviorally modern. So anatomically modern means they have the same skull shape in particular that we have, but the archaeological signature of their, you know, that tells us about their behavior is they aren't yet behaving like we think we do. So they're anatomically modern with the skull shape, but not behaviorally modern with behaviors we recognize as something we might do. But that changes about 120 years ago, maybe 100,000 years ago. We start seeing signs that look to us like stuff we might do if we were living under similar conditions. And so it really starts to become increasingly obvious, this behavioral modernity, another term that's very loaded with controversy because not everybody believes in behavioral modernity. And there's very compelling arguments that since we're not evolutionarily finished, there's no such thing as behavioral modernity. But at about 50,000 years ago, the signature becomes pretty unambiguous that they behave a lot like we do. And part of that is because right around then you cross the preservation horizon so that things that you couldn't see in the record before, all these behaviors with materials that don't preserve, all the organic stuff, well, the organic stuff starts preserving after about 50,000 years. So all of a sudden you get an enriched view of what the lifestyle was like, and all of a sudden it really starts looking like us. And that may be an artifact of preservation rather than a true change in the behavior. So we're sort of sensitive to the fact that there's some interpretational issues with what we see and what we don't see.
So let's go back to numerosity. You mentioned that usually people in different societies naturally, let's say, are able to count up to three or four, and then they have to use some auxiliaries like their fingers or tools or something like that. Is that really a human universal, that people without the aid of some tools or their fingers can only count up to three or four?
So everybody, all the human species, just like all species, has this ability to appreciate quantity. What the human species has that's different is two things. One is our use of material culture qualitatively and quantitatively different. So other species use material culture, but we use it more, and we use it in different ways. And we specifically use it for cognitive purposes, which I don't really see other species doing. And so our interaction with material form changes it, and then we teach that interaction to our children, and when they interact with that material form has changed in ways that their interaction with it changes them. The way our system of writing changes into a system of literacy is a good example of this. because writing starts out as little pictures, and over about 1500 years changes into a system of literacy that's expressive of language, not just semantic meaning. That required reorganization of behaviors and brains, which is stored in the specific material form of writing that is passed on at each point in time. And with the result that you start out with a system that anyone can read. Heck, I can look at Sumerian pictographs and I can tell that a head means something like head. But when it comes to cuneiform, about 15 centuries later, to me it just looks like chicken scratches because I haven't been trained to read it. And so that process of arriving at a material form that requires training to be able to engage with it, that process of change represents an accumulation of cognitive effort from the generations that handled that material form and changed it as they passed it along. So going back to numbers, we all start with this perceptual experience of quantity, and we all have this ability to use material culture in ways that let us express that perception of quantity and manipulate it and make it explicit and start to elaborate it. We all have the ability also to express these things in language, which is the other big difference that we have relative to other species. And arguably, along with language, we have the ability to teach each other. So we have social learning and the ability to not just observe what mama chimpanzee is doing, but we have the opportunity to ask questions and say, hey, could you, even just to say, I didn't quite see that, could you do it again? So the argument in stone tools is that at some point stone tools became complex enough that you had to have language to explain the technique. So that's a different argument for when language might have emerged as indicated by the complexity of stone tool manufacture. Again, it's language is one of those domains that's very, very hard to get at because there's no actual evidence of language evolution. What we have to do is infer it from indirect evidence, and the indirect evidence, you have to have a theoretical underpinning that says I can argue from here to this conclusion from data that isn't about language to a conclusion that is about language, and here's why I can argue the two. Numbers are a little bit different because for a couple of reasons. One is we all have numerosity and we can see that it would always have been there because it is so distributed within vertebrates today. And by the way distributed traits work, that means all the ancestors in between us and fish had it as well. Certainly between us and chimpanzees, which is the ones we're most directly concerned with, which means all our hominid ancestors had this ability to appreciate quantity in the primate way. And so we can already say that ability, which is the foundational ability to realize numbers and numeracy, the ability to reason with them, that's there as far back as we go, before the first tools show up. But once the first tools start showing up, it's probably not when we start getting concepts of numbers, but when the first tools start showing up, we have another essential ingredient for realizing number concepts, which is using material culture and starting to leverage material culture for cognitive purposes, accumulating and distributing cognitive effort between individuals and generations. And then whenever language comes around, and I think language is an essential ingredient for numeracy, then you have the major pieces there, and that's probably about when you get a sense a concept of a number that would look like a number to us. Let's put it like that.
Yeah, very interesting. Is there any way for us to be sure that an object or a collection of objects were really used for counting? I mean, how can we know that?
Well, the first unambiguous numbers are really, really recent. They're only about 5,000 years old. And our numbers are specifically connected to them through the intervening steps. So if you go back to Mesopotamia, for example, in the late 4th millennium BCE, they start taking these clay shapes, the tokens that I mentioned earlier, and they start impressing them in clay. And when we find the two of them together, and there are, I don't know, about two dozen or so assemblages where you have both the tokens and the impressions, and they match in terms of their size and shape and quantities, more or less well matched, you know, because archaeologically, stuff that's 5 or 6,000 years, you don't always have the perfect one, just like it came out of the factory. You have the one that, you know, parts are missing and parts are broken. But a couple dozen of these assemblages where you can see both the tokens and the notation, the impressions, and the impressions then correspond to later notations that are unambiguous in their numerical organization structure and content. And so if you walk that back, you can say, well, in the 4th millennium BCE, these tokens had numerical meaning also. Now, tokens have been, items categorized as tokens have been found all the way back to the 9th millennium. But it's really difficult, if they're not impressed in clay that we can connect to the notations that are later, just some bit of clay that looks like it has the right shape, you really don't know if it had a numerical purpose or not. So I kind of date the tokens. They're probably earlier than the 4th millennium BCE, but how much earlier, we really don't know. So the other kind of artifact that comes up in prehistoric numeracy are tallies, you know, bones with notches on them. And so Francesco Derrico has crafted in the early 90s, he crafted some diagnostic criteria. You look at these things through the microscope and try to see, were they made by the same tool or different tools? So the cut, the way the things are angled and the microscopic grooving gives you an idea of if it's a different tool or if it's the same tool. If it's the same tool, maybe they were sitting there making a decoration. If it's made at the same time, it may not be counting. It seems more consistent with a purpose like decoration. If it's made at different times, the notches are accumulated a few here and maybe a few there, maybe that's a little bit more like counting. The way we understand kind of the social purpose of counting is accumulating and not just sitting there, you know, making marks. But that's just a way of saying, well, maybe it could have been used for counting. It's not a way of saying it absolutely was used for counting. So we have these things that look like tallies. We treat them like tallies. We try to prove through microscopic analysis that they could have been tallies. Another technique for trying to understand their numerical intent is to say, well, what numbers do they represent? So the number 28 or 29 is very significant because that's the number of the lunar month. And so if we find a series of 28 or 29 notches, we say, aha, maybe they were counting the night or the nights of the moon. But, you know, if you come up with a number like 55, what does that mean? You know, heck, we have no idea. And so if it's not anchored to a natural phenomenon that we know about, if it relates to something like bride price or social debt or redistribution, we would have no idea. The other thing that's looked at, there's an artifact from Ishango in Africa that has it's rows of notches on this piece of bone. One row looks like the prime numbers between like 9 and 21, and that's a very statistically improbable sequence that it would be the indivisible primes. Right, a prime is divisible only by itself in one, that it would be the prime sequence between in this range. That seems phenomenally unlikely to have occurred by chance. But why would they have put that on there? You know, it's not completely out of the realm of probability that it could have been by chance. Some of the other rows look like 10 and 20 plus and minus 1. And another row looks like halving and doubling. So like 4 and 8, 5 and 10. And to have all of these on the same sequence, you say, surely it must have been mathematical. And it's a very famous artifact. And they say, well, I forget exactly how old it is. Let's say 20,000 years. That in Africa they were dealing with some pretty advanced concepts of numbers at 20,000 years ago. There is, in fact, a second bone found in the same level in the same cave at the same site, and it's not famous. And I can only guess that it's because the notches on it are not mathematically suggestive. So we have these hints, we have these clues, we have these things that seem phenomenally unlikely if we were to interpret them non-numerically, but there's really still nothing that closes the gap and says, yes, absolutely, this was a demonstration of mathematical knowledge at 20,000 years ago. So that's exactly the work that I'm working on right now. And as soon as I answer it, I'll let everybody know.
So if I understand it correctly, there are things in archaeology, I mean, some hypotheses that we cannot really definitively prove that they are right or wrong, right?
Well, by nature of the beast, and especially when it comes to cognition, right? We cannot. It's impossible. I mean, when we do psychological testing today, we sit somebody down in front of a computer screen, whether it's a human being, an infant, or a chimpanzee, and we give them stimuli and we measure their reactions, or we give them a task and we watch how they perform it, or we, if they're remote enough from humans, we stick probes in their brain and see which neurons fire when we make them do certain stuff. And so we can understand living species in a way that we can't possibly get at with extinct species. We do some work with what's called paleoneurology, so inferring something about the brain from the skull shapes they leave behind, right? So from a skull and what's called an endocast, which is the visualization of the negative space the brain would have inhabited, an endocast will give you an approximate size of the brain, some indication of the respective size of the major lobes. Perhaps you might get some of the major landmarks, like the central sulcus and so on. But you don't necessarily get anything about the, well, absolutely, you don't get anything about the interior of the brain. So we don't know, for example, whether ancient hominids had the same kind of Broca's and Wernicke's areas that we have. We know there's homologs in living apes to these areas that are so important for language. So we assume that there was some analogous neuroanatomy in our ancestors, but it's not anything we can see from what we do know about and can infer from their skulls and their endocasts. So it's by definition we are limited to indirect evidence, and when you're arguing from indirect evidence to a conclusion about something about a cognitive capability, then you can just try and make that inferential argument. So if you were arguing a legal standard, it's sort of the difference between a preponderance of the evidence and beyond a reasonable doubt, right? We try to meet a preponderance of the evidence. We try to get close to beyond a reasonable doubt. But we never quite get, we'll get as close to it as we can, but we never quite get there. And it's the nature of an inferential argument and the kind of evidence that we necessarily have to use.
So just one last question. You've already talked a little bit about this, but you mentioned at a certain point earlier that tools came before language, or at least that's the take that some people have. So what would be the relationship between tool making and language? I mean, would it influence the evolution of language or not?
Well, again, gee, language is a really difficult question because nobody really knows when, and nobody really knows how, and nobody really knows why. And so when you put all those things together, you've got a lot of different answers. I've mentioned a couple. That there's an underlying capability for chaining movements together or chaining of actions together that may underlie both the expression of of complex motor actions in tool making and the expression of complex utterances in language. So that's one theory. Robin Dunbar has the theory that, so as our social groups got larger, what apes, we're an ape, we're apes, and primates are very social species. And one of the ways, if you're an ape or a monkey, one of the ways you show that sociality is you pick fleas off each other. There's this bodily grooming. And as the social group gets larger, Dunbar theorizes, our ability to pick fleas off each other decreases because there's only so much flea picking you can do in a day, and it necessarily limits your interaction to fewer and fewer individuals relative to an increasing group size. So his theory is that language is a way to socially groom more of your social others that you can't get at by picking their fleas. And that's called the well, it's part of the social brain hypothesis, which is this idea of group sizes getting larger and being related to primate brain size, but also the fact that, I guess, he must be really popular at parties. He goes around and he listens to what people are saying, and he says mostly what we talk about to each other is gossip, and gossip is social grooming. So that's sort of what underpins his theory in sort of flippant terms. There's another theory that Ian Davidson and William Noble put together that it's about that language is about representation. So they look to the archaeological record of depictive art to say here we're representing a bison on a cave wall, and it's the ability to form a concept and make a gesture, and this reflects on an ability to represent that is related to the ability to represent with sound, which is what language is. Still another school of thought thinks that there's a gestural origin of language. I am not a fan of the gestural origins hypothesis because apes vocalize. And they also make gestures, but they vocalize. And so it doesn't make sense to me that we go from an auditory communication modality to a visual one like sign language, and then back to an auditory one, which is human speech. That seems very complicated. It's not a parsimonious explanation, and so I personally don't subscribe to it. Having said that, I went to I attended a Skype meeting a couple of months ago where that theory was presented as a precursor. So it wasn't an either or of it was visual then auditory then visual. I mean, excuse me, auditory then visual then auditory. But maybe the addition of gesture provided some scaffolding for the further development of the auditory expressive modality, and I thought that was really reasonable. It was just a new way of presenting that theory that I found more compelling than my previous understanding of it. So we really don't know. Noam Chomsky, who's probably one of the most famous linguists on the planet, has argued, and I find his take really pretty computationalist. It's like if you're going to build a computer chip that goes from a finite state grammar or an ability to put very simple things together with words to an infinite, you know, this ability to generate a near infinite number of novel sentences, that the technological challenge of going from finite to infinite state is the same no matter how many steps you actually have on the finite side. It's a nice computationalist kind of argument. And so from that, he concludes that we had a very recent genetic mutation, and we were given the ability for language all of a sudden, that it just appeared and it was a matter of a genetic mutation, and all of a sudden we could talk. Because the technical challenge of jumping to an infinite state grammar is so large that you can't achieve it by steps, no matter how many steps you have. There are others who take a more gradualist position and say, well, there were a lot of precursors and probably some simple things that constituted a proto-language where maybe things were put together very simply, and over time that became more complex, and you know, they looked at things like what's called motherese, the little sounds we make to babies to get them to respond to us, or sign language, or trying to teach home signs to apes. So Noam Chomsky, who's named after Noam Chomsky, Noam Chomsky and his ability to, some of them don't use home signs. They teach them this board of lexigrams. And they can learn to make what seems like a few simple sentences together. They never even achieve the grammatical capability of a 2-year-old child, even after extensive training. So there is something different about the brain in humans that gives it this language ability. But when that happened, why it happened, how it happened, there's a lot of theories, and it's a very active area of investigation.
Yeah. So, Dr. Overman, let's end the interview here. Would you just like to mention where can people find your work on the internet?
Well, so I have a website on academia.edu. If you know my name and you look me up, you can find my work online. I'm also in ResearchGate, I have a faculty webpage on the Center for Cognitive Archaeology website. And gosh, you can buy my books through Amazon. So all two of them.
Yeah, I will leave links to all of that in the description box of the interview so that people can go and check out your work. It's very interesting, and I love the book, by the way, Squeezing Minds from Stones. And Dr. Overman, thank you a lot again for taking the time to come on the show. It was a pleasure to have you.
A real pleasure for me as well.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. As you might have noticed, I've started this channel back in February 2018 and have been putting out regular interviews with academics and intellectuals from a variety of fields. And to keep the channel sustainable, I would like to ask you to please visit my Patreon page and to consider making a pledge there. And I also have links to PayPal in the description box of the interview. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my patrons and main supporters, Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Per Olga Larsson, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunde, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, David Diaz, Anian Kata, Jacob Klimpy, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollacy, Eric Alenius, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegger, Rui Inácio, Arthur Coe, Marco Neves, Max Belby, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Thomas Trumbull, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, Jorge Espinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Mikkel Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernard Hugni, Alexander Dunbauer, Omari Hickson, Felicia Stevens, Fergal Cusson, Yevhen Bodrenko, Hal Herzog, Nuno Machado, Don Ross, João Alves da Silva, Jonathan Labrant, Oslem Bulut, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W., João Eira, Tom Hummel, Sardus France, David Sloan Wilson, and Diacila Deza Araújo. My producers, Cesar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Stafiniak, Dr. Ian Gilligan, Sergio Quadriano, Luis Caetano, Matthew Lavender, Tom Van Egdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Giddy, and my executive producers, Michel Rugieski, Rosie, and James Pratt. Thank you for all.